of two-dimensional conformal field theory that had a very specific value of the central charge. We had an infinite family of two-dimensional conformal field theories that have any minimal models. The origin of the name being that these are the CFTs, which are the simplest, that have a finite number of operators. And we saw that they can be labeled by two relatively prime positive integers. And they have a central charge which is smaller than one. And in fact, it's equal to something like 6 minus p minus q squared p times q. And the thing that that we did was to notice that if we tune the values of h, so the value of the weight of the primary to be some very specific values. Let me write the correct formula, which was something like PR minus QS squared minus P minus Q squared divided by 4PQ. And R and S, R goes from 1 to Q minus 1, S goes to 1 minus P minus 1. And there is a reflection identification where you reflect. One way to think about this is that you can write these operators in what's called a CAC table. So you have a label R, a label S, and essentially you have a line, a reflection line. And here you would have S goes to P minus 1. You have 1 up to P minus 1. 1 up to q minus 1. And here you have a lattice of points. That tell you which operator we're talking about. And but there is a symmetry in this diagram, and these operators are just exactly the same as the image. Same formulas. We had operators, so these are the dimensions. The set of operators we called phi rs had the symmetry of Q minus R, P minus S. Okay? And what we did is we deduced, knowing the fact that by construction we chose the values of H that had null vectors. So primary phi RS has a null vector, which we constructed explicitly for level 2. Has a null vector at level 2. And using the fact that this null vector has to decouple from correlation functions, we were able to determine what are the fusion, so let me introduce some notation, the fusion matrix that tells you how two operators, the OPE of two operators, what are the quantum numbers that can appear in the OPE of two operators. And in particular, we saw that if you take, am I going to need that? No, I don't know. Okay, so what else do you want to say? And the point is that we use the decoupling null vector equation. Remember that this was a differential equation that we derived from our knowledge of the fact that there is a null vector, chi of z, some operator at level rs, if you want to label it like that. The existence of this operator implied that the correlations of primaries satisfied some differential equation. And we use this differential equation for the three-point function to determine the fusion rules. which tell you essentially what is the what representations of which operators appear in the product of two given operators, of two given representations. This sometimes is written like this, and this is something that probably you'll see next week when you look at the partition function and boundary CFT. The way this is represented is that you take the product of two operators that have a label I and J. So in this case, I and J would be one of these pair of indices, all right? This can be characterized as some integer matrix times phi of k, okay? And this is called the fusion matrix. And for this rational field, these are just numbers. It tells you how many, exactly like the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, when you multiply two representations of angular momentum, it tells you with the coefficient of, it can be zero, if the representation that you have here does not appear in the tensor product, and it can be one if it appears. Okay? And then what we were left to do, so notice that using this for the three-point function only told us, well, which is a lot already, but it told us what are the non-zero three-point functions. So it told us if I choose two representations, it tells you which representation you have to insert in order to get a non-zero correlation function. But it didn't tell us the value of the three-point function. So let me say it maybe in this way. So we had here we have something that we care about, which is the value. Well, we care about many things, but this is one of the major ones, which is some coefficient, which is the value of the three-point function times the usual z minus I2 business, which you know how to put now. And the information that we extracted from the fact that, for example, that in the minimal models, all the primaries have null vectors, was a relation between the quantum numbers here, okay? Remember, I wrote some formula that told you that if this guy, for example, is the 1-2 operator, there is a relation between this, and this guy has dimension H2, the dimension of this guy has to be some very specific value. You can only take two different values, okay? But that analysis did not tell us at all what this coefficient is, and that's something that hopefully we'll do today. But the way to extract that coefficient will be by computing the four-point function and then factorizing. But, okay, I'll do that later, hopefully. And then, so the next thing so that's where we start, essentially. So the thing that remains to do is to the four-point function. Using the same idea, you have a non-trivial differential equation. And here, unlike here, this will give us a differential equation for the complete four-point function. And then using the fact that the four-point function, remember that in one of the lectures I was saying that you can compute the four-point function by doing sequential OPEs. We had these pictures of colliding operator 1, 2, and 3, 4, right? I do the OPE of 1. So here we'll compute it exactly, just solving the differential equation. We can also compute it by doing the OPE of 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, and by looking at the four-point function in this limit, where you approach 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, we'll be able to extract this coefficient. Because remember that in this limit, what appears is the three-point function gluing 1, 2, and k, and the three-point function gluing k, 3, and 4. Okay. So we're going to do this for the Ising model, CFT. Okay. But before doing that, let me see what I want to say. So I just want to remind you that why this is important, all these different CFTs. And the point was that at the beginning of the course, we discussed how conformal field theories describe the critical behavior of certain statistical systems near a continuous phase transition. And you can either try to study the critical properties of that phase transition by directly solving the lattice model, which is very, very hard. It's much harder than, so all these things that we've been doing, it looks hard. It's child's play compared to actually solving the exact model. But the whole point of the idea of renormalization, the fact that you have a system that has fluctuations at large distances, which is what happens when you are near a critical point, because the whole point is that when you're approaching the critical point, the variables in your system, like the spins, are correlated at larger and larger distances. And then the whole idea of the renormalization group was that the details of what was the short distance Hamiltonian at very short distances is not very important. What matters more is what are the macroscopic variables that will describe the large distance physics. So you don't have to know all the details that's happening at short distance. All you need to know is what variables to use to describe the large distance fluctuations. And notice that this was the idea also behind universality, that even though you can have two Hamiltonians that at very short distances look different, if they have the same symmetries, they can be described at the same critical point at very large distances. Because the details of what happens at very short distances is not relevant to describe what happens at very large distances. Okay? That's this idea of that the physics at very short distances at above the cutoff scale is not very important to describe physics around us. It's not very important. So, and these CFTs, what they do is define, for example, in particular, these CFTs define what I call different universality classes. Which means that you have a fixed point here, which is one of the CFTs. And this fixed point describes the long distance behavior of a whole bunch of quantum field theories. And the slogan is that even though these field theories might look different at very short distances, they are described at the same fixed point, and therefore they belong to the same universality class. So they have the same critical exponent. Remember that here, that the thing that we care about is at the fixed point, what we care about is how quantities scale as a function of the parameter or parameters that you have to tune as you approach the fixed point. Okay. And the thing that I already mentioned before is that the thing that's very remarkable is that there are physical systems that look completely different. You're even measuring different things, like I mentioned the example of measuring the exponent for magnetic sensitivity and say of a magnet and compressibility of water, which a priori have nothing to do with each other, but the scaling behavior is the same. Okay, the coefficient of the exponents as a function of the parameter that you have to tune is the same, and that is that was a prediction of this idea of the normalization group, that if systems have the same symmetries, they should have the same critical exponent. Okay, so well, hopefully this is useful. I don't know. But, so now what I want to do is describe the from various points of view, and you have to tell me which point you want me to emphasize more, but I want to describe the critical behavior of the Ising model, of two-dimensional Ising model. So the starting point is one of these short-distance Hamiltonians, which is hard to solve, but in this case is one of the examples where smart people manage to solve. But it's hard. And notice that this was a Hamiltonian whose basic variables are spins that take values 1 and minus 1. They have a spin-spin interaction, which is nearest neighbor. And K is some energy scale that tells you the energy that it costs to flip one spin. or K is, in some sense, is the temperature. There is only one dimensionless constant here, which is the energy scale, or flipping one spin divided by the temperature. So everything is measured in terms of this dimensionless constant. OK, and this is defined in some, say, square lattice. And here you have spins. And they can be, OK, oh, you have yellow? So it can be either positive, so the spin lives at the sides, right? And at each side, it can be positive or negative. I mean, the spin can either plus or minus, essentially. Okay? And the partition function of the system, which from which we derive all thermodynamical quantities, is the sum over all possible spins of all sum over all spins on all lattice sides of this Boltzmann, of the usual Boltzmann factor, so minus k. Okay. So what are some of the things that we know about this? What we know is that this system, at I want them to align. So I think here I want a minus sign. Okay, it's an ferromagnetic spin chain. What I mean by this is that at very low temperatures, so what am I doing here? So I'll draw this diagram, but before that, just intuitively, at low temperatures, what these things like to do, nearby spins like to align each other, because that lowers the energy of the system. So at low temperatures, we are in the ordered phase. And spins are aligned, okay? Like to be aligned because of this sign. Nearby spins lower the energy of the system. But as you increase the temperature to high temperature, you start having very large thermal fluctuations. So the thermal energy at the temperature T can be large enough that it likes to flip spins, okay? And if you go to sufficiently high temperature, you're in a completely disordered phase where the spins are kind of completely uncorrelated with each other. And, well, now we know, but the point is that at some intermediate temperature, TC, there is a phase transition between the ordered phase and the disordered phase. Okay? And this is the prototypical type of phase transition that appears in a statistical mechanics. You have a phase, which is the high temperature phase, where the system is disordered. So in this case, in particular, something that is important to notice is that this Ising model has a symmetry. Can someone identify a symmetry of this Hamiltonian?
Invert.
Can you say more precisely what that means?
I mean,
yes, okay, so there's a Z2 symmetry. So there's a Z2 symmetry. That maps sigma to minus sigma. This is a symmetry of the system. And what happens is that in the ordered phase, since not all spins are aligned, the symmetry of the Hamiltonian is broken because you don't have any more the Z symmetry. And at high temperature, on the other hand, you have the, since essentially you have the restored Z symmetry. And this is a prototypic example that is generic to what happens in this kind of lattice model, where you have in a high temperature, the system preserves the symmetry of the Hamiltonian. But at low temperatures in the ordered phase, the symmetry is broken. Okay? Very good. And a slightly more careful analysis that I'm doing here. The thermite, but not much more careful. Maybe I'll do it. Let's see. Tell us a little bit. Let's look a little bit at the phase diagram. And I drew this already at some point.
Let's see, so I can turn on a magnetic field. I didn't write that, but I could have turned on a magnetic field to the system. And here I have the temperature. And what happens is that below a certain temperature, which is TC, the critical temperature, below this, we're in the ordered state. So it spins, you have a non-zero magnetization. That's the quantity that the magnets have, magnetization. And
so in principle, all spins could be up or down. But the symmetry is broken. If you just turn on an infinitesimally small magnetic field, it will determine the direction, because it's like being at the top of a hill. Just a small perturbation will determine which direction you roll. So here we'll have positive, and this will have negative. Here you have zero magnetization. You are in the disordered space. And here you have the critical point. Okay. And now what we're interested in studying the physics here. Okay. So one way of proceeding would be to solve, if you can, exactly the calculate exactly the partition function of the system and all observables by being able to do that sum over configurations in the spin. That's hard, okay? That's very hard to do. Well, in this case, it's doable, but in general, it's very hard. The other way that is more in the framework of the stories I was telling you about the renormalization group is to just try to isolate what are the basic variables that are important to describe the large distance physics. Remember that the critical point, we are looking at fluctuations at very large distances, and all that we need to do is identify a variable that describes these long distance fluctuations and that it has the right symmetries of the short distance Hamiltonian. And this idea, I mean, you may have seen this in your statistical mechanics course. This is kind of the Landau and Ginzburg description of a statistical systems, where you identify an ordered parameter, which is namely a field that captures what are the important fluctuations of the system, large distance fluctuations of the system. And in this case, the parameter that is important is the magnetization. So when we go to very large distances, the fact that the system is a lattice is not very important, because you're looking at distances which are much larger than atomic scale, and then you can describe the system. That's the beauty of studying physics near a second order phase transition, is that you can go from this complicated lattice system to a continuum field theory description, where the magnetization is a continuous function of space-time. So it's going to be described by a field phi of x. And then the idea is that you write down the most general action that describes fluctuations of this field, which is consistent with the symmetries here. And that's where this idea of relevant, irrelevant, which is a very important, if anything you come out of this course, you should understand that, is the fact that now we're studying at very large distances. The philosophy here is that even though we don't know, in this case we know what the short distance Hamiltonian is, but in general, like when we study quantum gravity or what's happening at the LHC, we don't know what's happening at the Planck scale. But the idea, what you do is that if you only are interested in some long distance physics, you write the most general interactions that are relevant or marginal, which are kind of important at large distances. Okay. So what are these? So phi should have fluctuations. This measures the fluctuations of phi. It tells you how phi here is correlated with the phi here, how much energy it costs to have a kind of a density wave where the magnetization here changes a little bit, like this. So phi here is correlated with phi here through the derivative. You can have a mass term. This is the lowest dimension operator you can write down. And now we use the fact that this system has an important Z2 symmetry. And we write what other relevant interaction well, if we were in four dimensions, could I write down? I could write down lambda phi to the four, okay? Plus other things, okay? Another point is that if I want to study the critical point, what I have to do is study the system. I have to study this Lagrangian that describes the long distance fluctuations and study the dynamics at the fixed point. So in four dimensions, so first of all, at the fixed point, since you have infinite correlation length, the effective mass here has to go to zero. Remember that we related the correlation length of the system with 1 over the mass. So the first thing that will happen is that at the critical point, the theory will have to be massless. There is no mass field. And, okay, you have to tune to this fixed point, which in four dimensions you do by doing this 4 minus epsilon expansion. But in two dimensions, okay, you can describe at the critical point, you can describe by this lambda phi to the fourth theory, essentially, okay? So now, okay, so let me tell you about two dimensions. So I'm trying to motivate several things. I mean, one of them is how you can go from the lattice description to some effective field theory description, which is the Landau network description, and see that, and in fact, that you can see some features of the critical system by studying this Landau network description. So in two dimensions, you would have said that, very naively, that the critical behavior of the Ising model would be described by such a field theory. And the thing that's non-trivial to show is that actually this theory, so this operator in two dimensions is relevant, right? Phi is dimensionless. Flows to an infrared fixed point. Which is precisely one of these minimal models. So therefore, by this sequence of logic, we've gone from the lattice system to an effective field theory to a particular conformal field theory that describes the infrared fixed point. And notice that once we're here, we don't need, in a way, we don't need to talk about anymore about this, but this was just to say that what's the logic of how you go from some lattice system to some conformal field theory. Any questions about this? Sorry?
Well, this is harder to establish, but one way you can see is that you can study the, well, you can make a mapping between the different operators in this theory. But I have to introduce the operators in the Ising model before I can map them to this. So you can find a map between operators here and operators in the Ising model. Oh, but notice that the reason what I certainly have motivated, I have not established that this guy is M43, but the thing I motivated is that this Landau network description should describe the large distance behavior of the Ising model, hopefully, of these 25 minutes, whatever about that. This step is much harder to establish. But the point is that in this case, it has been completely. Okay, so now should I tell you more about the lattice description? Maybe not.
I mean, this Ising model has an infinite number of beautiful things associated to it, and it provides a lot of insight on many different kind of hard issues, conceptual issues in field theory. So, if you really, I would recommend that you study its properties in detail. It has duality, which I may or may not get to it. I mean, you might have seen this in your StackNet course, the fact that it has a high temperature, low temperature duality, which is kind of something that is the first example, is the first non-trivial example of a field, of a system that exhibits a duality property, which many other field theories in higher dimensions, usually supersymmetric field theories in higher dimensions exhibit, like as duality. But this is a framework where you can completely understand that. It's not some string theories talking about dualities. You can actually see it with your hands. And it has also connections with integrable systems, the fact that you can study conformal field theory and make a deformation of a conformal field theory by a relevant operator. And even though you break conformal symmetry, the theory is still soluble because there is a conserved higher spin current that allows you to solve the theory. So it has connection to integral models. Essentially, it connects to everything that's useful the Isaac model knows about. Okay, so now let's study the... Yeah, so this particular minimal model, so the M43 minimal model. So from what I wrote here, we know that it has three primary operators, which has 1 times 4 minus 1 times 3 minus 1. Yes? And now let's compute the dimensions. Notice that the first part of the identification between this and the Ising model was that, in fact, this wasn't a case where the Ising model people had solved before using very fancy techniques. So one of the checks that this guy is indeed describing the critical behavior is to compute the critical exponents using the CFT and compare them with the exact results that you obtain from the lattice system. And of course it works, otherwise I wouldn't be telling you about it. But let's compute what these things are. So first of all, this guy has 3 primaries. It has central charge 1/2. This is a point that's important, and I will try to come back to, which is related to some free fermion CFT. So this is an example where this construction of the CFT that I did kind of very algebraically by thinking about null vectors and finding a restricted set of operators that that fuse into each other under the OPE. This is an example with actually this algebraic construction has an explicit Lagrangian description in terms of the free fermion. Okay. And I may come back because the fermion picture also gives you insights about the relation between the lattice model and the conformal field theory. So let's see. And what are the dimensions of the operator? So it's that formula there, but let's plug in now Q equals 3 and P equals 4. Well, okay, I don't need to do this algebra in front of you. There are 3 operators. H12, so I have an operator, which is I call the identity, that corresponds to 1/1, which has dimension 1. Also, by this folding business, you can either represent it in this wedge by 1/1 or in the other wedge by 2/3. Then we have an operator that I'm already writing it as sigma for reasons that will become clear, which is associated to 1/2 and has dimension 1/16. Just plug in here, I mean, it's completely trivial. And if I go to the other wedge, it's H22. And then there's an operator that we'll call epsilon, which is the other one, 2/1, has dimension 1/2, and is related to 1/3. Okay, if you go to the other wedge. So this CFT has 3 primary operators. The identity is always there. And then sigma and epsilon. Now let me try to tell you a little bit what are these in relation to the story I was telling you about. So this sigma is the description in the continuum limit of the spin at site I. So this you associate with the spin in the Ising model. And the way we will test it is that remember that the critical exponent, one of the critical exponents in statistical mechanics, is measured by computing the correlation between the basic microscopic variables in the theory, like sigma x, sigma y, which people know how to compute in the lattice model. And we'll compare it with the two-point function of sigma. And see you get the right thing. But also, okay, that one. And here, the epsilon, this epsilon is called the energy operator. And the way you should think about that is that this epsilon operator is the operator that measures the energy associated to a particular spin. So you should think of it as a spin times another spin. Quotes. Okay. Another way to think about this, which is useful, is that we have a CFT with two non-trivial relevant operators. So imagine now we're sitting at the fixed point here. We can try to develop an intuition by comparing with the lattice model of what would be the effect of now. So I'm using a Lagrangian description just to say something, but where I have S CFT, which is this Isaac model CFT, and now I perturb away by making a small variation. I make a small perturbation by this operator and a small perturbation by this operator. Okay. So first of all, this, since this operator is relevant, right? Both operators are relevant. This is breaking conformal symmetry because this guy has no dimension, does not have the right dimension to be marginal. But what this is doing, and that we call it the energy operator, essentially what this is doing is changing the value of K. So what it does is change KC, because at the critical point, K is the critical temperature, to KC plus delta K. And this guy, what it does is, from the lattice point of view, is turn on a magnetic field. So these are the two possible deformations that you can have in the Ising model. You can either change the temperature. You can always do that. That's what experimentalists do. And you can also turn the magnetic field, which is something experimentalists do. And in the lattice description, it would correspond to adding to the Ising Hamiltonian, adding if it's small, like delta B, sigma I. So magnetic field couples to spin in this way. Okay. So now with this data, we can extract the critical exponents. So remember that the way we define critical exponents, and you've seen in your StatMech course, was one of them is in terms of the two-point function. So you want to measure the correlation length, the correlation between the basic degrees of freedom of your system, which in this case are the spin. Okay. And so what you want to compute, what is the correlation of a spin at site I with a spin at site I plus n. So some guy, some lattice, some spin that is a distance n away from the original spin. And you want to know how this scales with n in the limits that n gets very large, where the distance between the two spins gets very large. And it's natural to define it in this way. Why? Because if sigma was a scalar field, and we were doing free field theory, we know that the correlation function of two scalar fields, massless scalar fields in D dimension, has this propagator. I hope by now this is done. And what this is doing, this eta, is a shift away from the free field value. So if it, yeah, so in some language, it could be thought of as the anomalous dimension of the operator signal. So by measuring the correlation between spins as a function of distance, we can compute this quantity. And this is something that experimentalists measure by probing how this spin here is correlated by this spin here. But in two dimensions, this just gives me 1 over n. OK, my n's and eta's look very similar, so why don't I call this x? And eta is one of the very important critical exponents. Another critical exponent that's important is the one that you compute by studying the correlation of the energy operator in the lattice model. And this is 1 over x, 2d minus 2 over nu, which in two dimensions is 1 over x to the 4 minus 2 over nu, where nu, remember, was intrinsically defined. And you can show this. I don't know if I'll do it. I mean, here, but this nu, remember, that it's the other basic important critical exponent that told you that as T goes, as the temperature goes to the critical temperature, the correlation length of the system diverges as a function of the control parameter with some characteristic power law, which is this nu. And this nu is exactly the same that appears here. And going from here to here is not hard, but maybe I will not take the time to do it. You have to use maybe things that you've seen, scaling relations. The fact that a different observable at a critical point satisfies certain homogeneity properties, and you can write the scaling behavior of certain operators in terms of essentially two basic, in this case, two basic exponents, which are eta and nu. So I could relate the two-point function of the energy operator to this nu critical exponent, which measures the way in which the correlation length diverges as I approach the critical point. And for reference, eta in the exact, okay, so this is in the exact solution, exact lattice solution. Using very hard work, you can show that this is, eta is 1/4. And nu equals 1. And now I want to see, we want to see what is the prediction that the 4.3 CFD has to make. Okay, so in order to answer this, how would you test that the Ising CFD exhibits this critical behavior?
Given all that I told you what the H is. So how, given H, how would we use H to compute this thing?
Where does H appear? Well, H appears all over the place, but where does H appear? This you have to know.
If you need the response for the amplitude functions, you might be possible.
Yeah, so, okay, yeah. So that's going in the right direction, yeah. But in particular, which endpoint function?
Well, I guess.
Like, we said that the one-point function was zero, right?
Yeah.
For a primary, unless it's identity. So the first one to be a two-point, the first case is the two-point function.
Two points, yes.
And remember the general relation that we derive using conformal word identities. That's why we did all that stuff, not just for fun. But it's not fun, but was to. So now, okay, now this, one thing I forgot to say is that these operators actually have the same dimension, h and h bar. So Pirasoro, holomorphic Pirasoro, and holomorphic Pirasoro. So for that particular case, when h equal this bar, then this guy was 1 over z for it. Okay. So this ring a bell. I hope this rings a bell, otherwise. Okay. So if I, that's why knowing the spectrum of h of the eigenvalue of the dilatation operator is the same as knowing the 2-point function. Because the 2-point function is just determined by scaling. So this now we calculate. So what are the scaling? These guys are sometimes called scaling operators or primary operators.
So let's compute. So using this formula, we can just determine that sigma z z bar sigma 0 equals, using the fact that sigma has a scaling dimension 1/16, you get here 1/4. So indeed, eta is 1/4. And now I compute epsilon, the 2-point function of the energy operator, which is the second primary. And using the fact that h is 1/2, this goes like 1 over z squared, which tells us that nu is 1, indeed. Okay? So by doing essentially nothing, we have reproduced the critical exponents of the Ising model. What would be the correlation function of good? Well, why is it 0? Very good. Yeah. So these are the only non-trivial 2-point functions we can construct, because sigma and epsilon have different dimensions. Okay, so the only thing I didn't explain, but it's very simple, and you can read in any statistical mechanics book, is how to use the scaling relations to go from here, which is the basic definition of mu, to here, okay? But I don't want to waste time with that. Okay, so now let's do some more. So we're on the right track. We've identified the correct critical behavior. Now what I want to do is, in order to study more details of the Ising model, and in particular, to know the 3-point functions. So far, this fancy business only told us the 2-point functions, but we need to know the 3 and the 4. And in order to determine that, we'll need to first study what are the fusion rules of the Ising CFT. So remember the fusion rules that we derived yesterday was obtained, well, were derived by starting with we did it explicitly for the degenerate field at level 2. We had a particular differential operator, second order differential operator, that we associate to the null operator. So there's a null state, and there's a corresponding null operator that you write down in the null differential operator. And from that, we extracted, this is the thing I was telling you at the beginning, we extracted the fusion rules. It told us, if you compute the 3-point function, what is the quantum number that the 3 operators that enter must satisfy in order to be non-zero. But as I said, it doesn't tell you what this number is. Okay. So using the fusion rules that we derived, remember that the fusion rules, and this is something that we derived. So 1-2, remember, 1-2 is just the spin operator. Remember that I said that this phi 1-2 acts like the spin 1/2. It raises and lowers this number by 1. So using this rule, we can just calculate all the fusion coefficients that you can get. So you can fuse sigma with sigma, which is phi 1 2 phi 1 2, and use this to obtain, and then using the identification that we know that epsilon is phi 2 1 or phi 1 3, and that sigma is phi 1 2 or phi 2 2, you get that the fusion of sigma with sigma gives me either the identity plus epsilon, sigma times epsilon gives me sigma, and epsilon times epsilon gives me the identity. Okay. So as you see, the Ising CFT has an incredibly simple fusion rule. It has three primaries, and the multiplication between the primaries is closed. You never get out of the... Let's notice something important here, which we already described there. Notice that these fusion rules have a symmetry. Can someone identify a symmetry of the fusion rules?
I'll look at the blackboard on top of it. That's a hint. So these guys,
yeah. How about sigma goes to minus sigma?
Well, that and the other ones are invariant, right? Which is exactly the Z2 symmetry of the Ising. Okay, now I have to decide whether I tell you about the fermions or I wait. And instead, yes. Yes.
Does n ijk in this case is one of those cases in which there are 0 or 1?
Yes, yes. So the coefficient here would be is exactly, so n sigma sigma 1 is 1, n sigma 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 0, and n sigma sigma epsilon is 1. These guys will play an important role when we study, well, when Eleonora tells you about the boundary, when you have CFTs with a boundary. Right now, we're just studying the theory in the plane with no boundary. So maybe I'll tell you a little bit about this. And if I don't get to what I wanted to get today, I'll do it tomorrow. What the hell? So now I guess I want to tell you a couple of words about the fact that for this particular CFT, we can also think of it in terms of a free fermion, okay? Without going into many technical details, because it can get a bit technical, but I just wanted to give you an idea of another way of thinking about the Ising model. I'm having the usual problem of running out of blackboards. Okay, so now let me write down for you CFT. Okay, a theory. Well, and you'll see, and you'll tell me why this is a CFT, which is a theory of a free fermion in two dimensions. In fact, it's in a way, yeah, okay, so let me write the action. Sub psi is a fermion. It's a real fermion. This comes from what I call Majorana fermion. You may have seen this word in your field theory class. This is the statement that psi is real, or that the antiparticle of psi is its own psi itself. It's its own antiparticle. It has the property. What is the equation motion of that psi satisfies? Good, yeah. So that means that psi is holomorphic, right? And this guy is anti-holomorphic. Notice that if we, just to connect, maybe, this might seem weird that you can have a fermion that's holomorphic, but if we were going to, if we're doing, here we're studying the theory in Euclidean signature. We went to Lorentzian signature. So you've studied the Dirac equation in a quantum field theory, and notice that when you're in even dimensions, two is an even dimension, fermions can have chirality. So does this word make sense? Chirality, or so you can further reduce a Dirac spinner into one which is has positive chirality and negative chirality. And I think it's a very good exercise for you to show that if you write down a two-dimensional fermion and decompose it into, so you have a Dirac fermion, and you decompose it into one that has a positive chirality and one that has negative chirality, to show that psi plus is right moving, so it moves at the speed of light in one direction, while psi minus is left moving. In formulas, that just means that d minus psi plus is zero, and d plus psi minus equals zero. This just follows from the Dirac equation in two dimensions. Okay? And this thing is just exactly the analog of this in Euclidean signature. But remember that we already said that right moving and left moving waves are moving at the light cones is equivalent to holomorphicity and anti-holomorphicity. So now you can tell me what is the dimension of psi, of deep psi. What is the dimension of psi? Tell me h and h bar. So h. I mean, you can read this from the Lagrangian, because there is nothing very fancy about it. Okay, which one has 1/2? Yes, you say this 1/2? It's correct. But okay, how did you get there? No, just I mean, I know you know, but just for everyone's education. Yes?
He said this.
Very good. And what about this bar? I mean, the anti-holomorphic dimension?
The same?
No. No, because it's zero. Yes. Because in a way, this guy already solved the dimension. The derivative del bar has h bar equals 1, and already solved the dimension. So the operator has holomorphic dimension 1/2 and anti-holomorphic dimension 0. While this guy is the opposite. Has the holomorphic dimension 1/2 of it. They are part of the world. It's psi bar is zero. Okay, the thing that's not obvious, but you can do is a simple extension of the exercise we've done for the free field. You can compute the central charge of this fermion by first computing the stress tensor and computing the OPE of the stress tensor with itself. That's where you get the central charge. Remember that the central charge was, you could read off from the 1 over z to the 4th fold in the OPE of t to 0. And if you do that, then the standard exercise, you get that c equals 1/2. In fact, also c bar equals 1/2. So notice that we're already getting the right CFT. And now, something that I have to tell you is how to relate the operator content
of the Isaac model using this algebraic language to this pedestrian language of Fermion. Oh, this is C over 2. Yes, thank you. Okay, so now I want to tell you how to write this in terms of that. And there's a subtlety here. Well, subtle business, this one. So which one do we start again? Eleonora, I don't think I'll get the modular invariant. You'll have to do it in the next class. Okay. You're more realistic than I am, I guess. Okay, so what we want to do is to find a mapping between these symbols, which are the three primaries. How do we relate these three primaries to these fermions? Okay. And so the energy operator is this, okay? So let's motivate that. Well, first of all, it has the right quantum number, right? Epsilon has h and h bar 1/2, and this guy obviously has h and h bar 1/2. But also, that's something that now you can understand better. Notice that I said that turning on epsilon here corresponded to what? It corresponded to moving us away from the critical point. But what is the physical interpretation of this term? So if I'm doing now S equals and I add a perturbation epsilon is something else, sorry. What is this? Sorry? Mass, side there. So and this fits with this intuition that if you move away from the critical point, you've broken conformal invariant. And giving a mass to a field breaks conformal invariant. So this operator, indeed, is precisely has exactly the same property as this epsilon operator here that was the one that moved us away from the critical point. And this language is very transparent that moving us away from the critical point introduces a mass scale, which is the mass of the fermion. Okay? And notice that now in this language, so this is a small comment I want to make, is that even though the Isaac model was solved in a very exotic way originally, now you could try to solve the Isaac model even away from the critical point by just solving that theory. Because you've mapped that model to a theory of a massive fermion, which even I can solve. But the important lesson here is that this idea that appears for the Isaac model where you can write explicitly the Lagrangian extends to all minimal models, which means that if you start with some CFT and you perturb by a relevant operator, like and actually the 1-3 operator, so if you perturb by phi 1-3, then you get one of these non-conformal, because this theory is not conformal, but integrable theories. So these are theories that have higher spin conserved currents that you can use if you're sufficiently strong to completely solve the theory. And in this baby example of the Isaac model, where this operator, again, is epsilon or phi 1-3, this kind of integrable deformation is very simple because it's just a mass deformation. Okay, now something a bit exotic. Hopefully not too outrageous. So what's different about the fermion as opposed to a scalar? Is that the fermion transforms in a spin-off representation, first of all. So that means actually geometrically iterate in a way which is as least complicated as possible. So just by looking at this action, I can impose some periodicity conditions on the fermion. Okay, so I'm in the complex plane, and I have my fermion field, and I want to move it around the origin. Okay, I'm moving it around the origin is just multiplying z by 2 pi I. It just means that you took this guy and you went around 2 pi. It turns out that for a fermion, there are two possibilities that are consistent with the fact that the action has to be invariant and Lorentz invariant. There are two possible signs you can get. It can either be periodic or antiperiodic. Periodic. Or it can be antiperiodic. You can pick up a sign. And the usual language for this, that's a couple you will see when you study in your string theory course, is that fermions that live in two dimensions, that live in the complex plane, those that are periodic are said to have what's periodic and antiperiodic changes if you are on the plane or on the cylinder. So now I have to remind myself. I think if you are on the plane, the one that's periodic is the Ramon sector. Is that correct? Oh, you have to check. Okay. Let me think 1 second. So in the cylinder, it's periodic. So, okay, so I think this is Neve-Schwarz. So this is called Neve-Schwarz, just to introduce you to the language. Boundary conditions, and these are Ramon boundary conditions. These are three famous. Okay, so when we study a fermion in two dimensions, you have to tell me whether you're imposing periodic or antiperiodic boundary conditions, because the two are consistent with Lorentz invariance. And now, imagine I want to study, did I say it correctly? Oh, very good. So now, we've identified epsilon, but we're still missing sigma. And now what I'll tell you is that sigma is an operator that exists in the CFD, it's a subtle operator that implements this boundary condition. So let me tell you a little bit about this. Which one is? Let me read this. Yeah. So imagine now I want to study antiperiodic. So I'm in the Ramon sector. The way you should think about this is that there's an operator here that sits at the origin. Okay? So you're in the complex plane. That creates discontinuity for the fermion. So the way to think about it is that there is a branch cut emanating from the origin of the complex plane that is produced by this operator sigma. It's like a Dirac string. So there is something that comes out of this point. The position of the line is irrelevant. All that it matters is that it goes from here to there. Infinity. You can do any answer you want. And it has a property that if I move my fermion around, since there's a branch cut, the fermion changes sign. So if you have psi q, you have minus psi. And this, in the language of conformal field theory,
of OPEs. What this means is that this operator has the following property. There's an operator in the CFD that if you take psi of z and you multiply by sigma 0, okay, let me write another way, right? So this is an operator that, as I said, creates this continuity of psi. And that's what you see in this OPE. If you take z, which is the location of the fermion, around the this guy is called spin field. This plays an important role in many places, and in particular spin field. If I move the fermion around the origin, I pick up a phase because I have a square root. So this sigma is an operational way of implementing the fact that the fermion is anti-periodic.
Okay. And now what you can, and that's a bit harder to do, the next thing I'm going to say, but maybe we will do it, maybe we won't, depending on how time goes. Okay, so first of all, let me say a few things. So this guy is the spin operator also it's called, and this guy is called disorder operator. So notice that the dimension of sigma and the dimension of mu is the same. Can someone tell me why?
Okay, of course, the half plus the descendant. So why is the dimension of sigma and mu the same? Yes?
Because the dimension of the dimension of is the same as
the sentence, yes. So the fact that this has a dimension of half, which is the dimension of 1 over z square root of z, tells you that the dimension of sigma is the dimension of mu. And this guy is called a disorder operator.
And I'll tell you, okay, I hope I have time to tell you why, because it's a very cool property of the Ising model. And now, the operator phi 1 2, remember that here we're trying to map the operators of the algebraic description of the minimal model in terms of in terms of the free fermion. We identify the epsilon operator, and now what I'm claiming is that this phi 1 2 is the spin field, or the spin operator. Yes, sorry. Yes, because take z, and now go around the origin. So take z into z to the 2 pi I. The square root of z will pick up a sign when I go around the origin.
Why do you just write it like that?
Because in CFT, these are the descendants. See, this is just an OPE. So in the OPE, you take two primaries, and you collide them, and you can get a whole bunch of primaries on the right-hand side, but it's descendant. Because this is the operator, that creates the ground state. Another way of saying it, it creates the ground state in the Ramon sector, in the antiperiodic sector. That's another way of thinking about it. You need to do something to force to change the boundary condition. And the way you do it is by inserting an operator. Something subtle, but this operator implements. So another way of saying it is that the ground state. So now you could think of quantizing psi and expanding into oscillator modes, right? So remember that. Well, first of all, psi is anti-holomorphic, right? So psi has an expansion in terms of modes like this. And now, depending on whether you're in the Ramon or the Levetscher sector, n will have to be integer or half integer, so it has the right predictive property. And this operator is the one that creates the ground state in this particular sector. But in conformal theory, you can construct the operator that does it. I mean, you create all states from all states are created from an operator, and the operator that creates that state is precisely this. And then this OPE is fixed by the fact that you know that in this sector you should pick up discontinuity, and that completely fixes this. Okay. It could be that you have other primaries here, but then the further analysis shows that there are no further primaries, although you have the descendants. But this is derived just from this couple of physical principles. Yes.
Have a sigma at 0 to say that you create the vacuum. That's because we define our vacuum when doing the quantization in the infinite past. The
so remember that the in vacuum in the cylinder map to the origin in the complex plane. And the sigma 0 acting on the vacuum creates
the in state with antiperiodic. Okay. I'm wondering, maybe I'll just say a few words qualitatively. So I told you about this guy. Okay, and the point is the identification is that this guy, now you can compute, in particular by doing what Eleanor is saying, by computing the, one way of doing it, by computing the energy of the state created by sigma, you can extract that this guy has H equals 1/16, which was the dimension of the 512 guy. And we gave an interpretation of this guy. This guy in the lattice model corresponds to the basic spin variable, but I haven't told you what this animal is. I'll try to now tell you something. This is very interesting because it's a Oh, I didn't do anything to that. I'm very disappointed. This operator is very interesting because it's kind of the first example of an operator that appears in duality. I'll say a few things, and if it doesn't make any sense, I can come back tomorrow. But if it makes sense, let's go ahead. I think some of these things you've seen in your course in statistical mechanics. So this partition function of the Ising model. Like that. Has two natural expansions, okay? One is, I will be confused by this, so if K is small, is that there is a high temperature expansion. That's in the limit that K is small, right? K is like 1/10. Where you can evaluate this partition function just by using the deep fact that e to the k, sigma I, sigma j, is the hyperbolic cosine of k plus sigma I, sigma j, the hyperbolic sine of k. And here all I'm using is that sigma squared is 1, because sigma is either plus or minus 1. And then a beautiful observation tells us, I want to make at least some numbers, right? So now all that you do is you can write this as the sum over all spins. So in this line, I haven't done absolutely anything yet. I'm just rewriting this partition function. Product of overall nearest neighbor sites of the cosh of k, 1 plus sigma I, sigma j, the hyperbolic tangent of k. Okay? And I haven't done anything. I just did the trivial rewriting of that sum into the sum. Well, the point now is that if you make a small k expansion, an expansion at small temperature, you can write this as a sum over loops. Which is the length to the, times a hyperbolic k times the length of the loop. Okay. So what you have to do is you take your lattice here, And in order to get a non-zero contribution at small energy, since this guy, H sigma I has to be summed over plus and minus one, okay? So in order to get a non-zero result, any given sigma has to appear twice. And that, in the language of this, means that you should be summing over loops. So that means, let me give you an example of a loop. So what you have to do is, this will be an example of a loop, closed loops. It has to be closed precisely because if it's open, you have a sigma that is free in some sense. So when you sum over that sigma, you will get 1 plus minus 1, which is 0. So here you have to sum over all possible, even disconnected closed loops on your lattice. Okay? That's just another way of rewriting this partition function, which is very useful. So that's one way. And then there's another way, which is so this was the high temperature expansion, then there is the low temperature expansion. The reason I'm telling you this is because I think it's anyway beautiful and important. And it's a baby example of things that appear later on and are kind of at the forefront of research now, which is understanding of dualities. Now, instead of doing an expansion when k is very small, let's do the expansion when k is very large, so the temperature is very, very small. So now we're in the low temperature expansion. So here, I'm not going to show all the details, but the basic idea is clear. At very low temperature, the system is ordered. So all spins are alike, all guys are up. And now you can do an expansion away from that by saying, now, at very small temperature, it costs me energy, a small amount of energy, if the temperature is small, to flip one spin. So all are up, and now I want to start summing over all possible ways of turning spins from all up to a few of them down. And what you can show, maybe I'm not sure I have a... I guess I'm taking a lot of time. If people are interested, I can explain this again tomorrow. Times. So again, the point is that you can write this as a sum over loops. But now you have a new expansion. Let me call it k hat, okay? Just not to complete that one. Where you sum over loops. But now these loops are a bit different. And the idea is the following, is that you have color, maybe. So everyone is up. So everyone is, say, plus. Essentially, this is the energy. This guy I pulled up is the energy of when all the spins are up. And this guy is the sum over what happens when I start turning one spin at a time. So so everyone is green, and now here this guy is wants to turn and wants to be white. Where, okay, so this is 1 and white is minus 1. Sorry? Oh, really?
Somewhere on the middle board. Sharon, there's
a game.
Oh, okay.
Maybe.
You do a cross. Sorry?
You do a cross,
then one. Sorry? I think the question. As usual, like a rock star. Okay, so now these loops I'm talking about here, so what has happened here? So I turned one spin, and since the interaction of a spin is with its nearest neighbor, essentially what I do is I have to count how much energy it cost me to do this, and the energy it cost me is that I have to change the sign of the interaction for all the bonds that go from here to all neighboring sites, right? Because I changed the sign of that interaction is K sigma sigma, but now I change the sign because this guy has opposite sign. So here, one way of thinking about it is that what I'm doing is a summing over loops like that. Okay, now we need another color. Okay. So here I'm summing over loops like this. Where the vertices of these loops now are at the center of the face of the original lattice. Okay? So if I define now what's called the dual lattice, okay, I should shape this. This is very useful. So I have the original lattice, the white lattice, and now what I've seen is that in order to define the low temperature expansion, it's useful to think of a dual lattice. Here we're summing over loops, just like we were summing over loops there. But now the loops are these other lattice. Maybe I can do it here. So this guy is the lattice. This guy is the dual lattice. And in the high temperature expansion, I'm summing over closed loops, where I do closed loops on the white lattice. And in the low temperature expansion, I do sum over closed loops. You should convince yourself that if you start reversing more spins now, what you have essentially is a picture of a domain wall, where you have a whole bunch of, imagine the greens are spin plus. So you have droplets of minus signs, surrounded by droplets of plus signs, and it's separated by a domain wall, which is a closed curve. Okay. So this shows you that you can think of the Yalting model at high temperature by doing an expansion in a large temperature on the original lattice, or a sum over loops in the at low temperature in the dual lattice. And then Kramer and Guarnier made this brilliant observation that, in fact, the two expansions are exactly the same. Keep losing everything today. Okay. The two expansions are the same if I identify the parameters of the expansion in a very specific way. And you can almost see it with your naked eye. That the two expansions are the same if I relate this expansion to that expansion by this relation. I think this is correct, but I mean the, hopefully the factors of two are correct. Okay. So these two expansions are exactly the same if I relate the parameters in the low temperature expansion and the high temperature expansion in this way. And this is a prototype of duality. So this is called Kramer's one-year duality. This is an example of what you could be, now we would call a strong weak coupling duality, because it relates a theory. Because actually, for this equation to be satisfied, if k is small, which is kind of the coupling constant of the original theory, k hat has to be large and vice versa. So you relate the theory at weak coupling, one theory at weak coupling, which is the, say, the high temperature expansion, to a theory at large coupling, which is the low temperature expansion. Okay? And all this story, well, apart because I think it's useful, was to explain what is the interpretation of this mu in the lattice model. And now the point is that what was the basic variable here? It was the sigmas. So this mu essentially is, if I calculate the two-point function, the correlation function of two spins in the theory with coupling constant k, okay, k hat, say in the low temperature phase, this mu is defined as the object that this correlation function maps under this duality transformation in the other theory. Okay. And this is an example of how duality maps a set of variables in one theory to a set of other variables in the other theory. And these are called disorder variables, disorder operator. This is the order operator. So remember that the order operator is the operator that condenses, that has a non-trivial expectation value in the ordered phase. At low temperatures, the Isaac model, all spins are like that. And the disorder operator is the operator that condenses, that has a non-trivial expectation value in the disordered phase. Okay. And if I had more time, I would tell you how you can compute the expectation value of mu directly in the Ising model. So if people are interested, I can do it next time, or otherwise I can point you to some reference. But the point now is that using this free fermion construction of this minimal model, we not only identified the order variables, which were the spin and the energy operator, but we discovered that actually the free fermion picture knows about the fact that the Ising model has a duality, and that you could have rewritten the theory by just a change of variables in terms of not using sigmas, but calculating in terms of mu. And the free fermion CFT knows exactly about that. And this is the guy that in the dictionary would correspond to this disorder operator in the Ising model. Okay. And, okay, so I'll stop here. And tomorrow we will finish the computation of the 3 and 4-point functions of the Ising model, and then Eleonora will take over with whatever she wants. Okay, thank you.